so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Hi, folks. I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer. This is Growing Bolder. Thanks for tuning in and joining us in our mission to change the way the world looks at aging.
Yeah, you know, Mark, that is a pretty big mission, but you know what makes it easy? All the amazing men and women out there who are smashing one stereotype after another and proving that it's never too late to find your purpose, to pursue your passion, to make a difference in your community.
You know, that's a great point, Bill. All we really have to do is run down these extraordinary people that are pursuing these amazing lives and then feature them right here on Growing Bolder Radio, as well as Growing Bolder TV and Growing Bolder Magazine. And, you know, Bill, that's what we're going to do right now. You know, Growing Bolder is about smashing stereotypes, and not because you want to, but because you just want to live your life, because you refuse to buy in to the ageist propaganda that it's too late to chase your dream, too late to make a difference.
Barbara Beskind smashes a handful of stereotypes every single time she goes to work. At 90, Barbara is by far the oldest member of the world-famous human-centered design team, IDEO, in Silicon Valley, where many of her co-workers, Mark, are 60 to 70 years younger than she is. Let's see what she thinks of that. Welcome to Barbara Beskind. How are you, Barbara?
I'm fine, thank you.
Oh, do we have the right guest on the show? We're supposed to talk to a 90-year-old. You sound much younger than that.
Oh, well, I brought somebody in to make to stand in for me.
So,
no, I'm 90 years old and very happy.
And how are you feeling these days?
This has been the most wonderful chapter of my life. I never could have believed I would have had this adventure, and I love it.
Yeah, you know what, and you wear it well, and thank you so much for not withdrawing when all of this is happening to you and standing up and representing, if you will, for the nonagenarians out there. You know, Bill mentioned that you work at IDEO. Tell us how you got the job, because Silicon Valley companies are notorious for hiring almost exclusively young employees. What led a 90-year-old to their door?
Well, I wrote a letter and told them I had skills that I'd always enjoyed. I've always been a very creative person. I've designed since I was age 8, and I felt that I could contribute to their organization, and I would like to have the opportunity to meet with them and see what they thought about my skills, and they took me on.
So basically, you just went for it. And I love that, because most people, you know, beyond 40 or 50 or 60, you know, we get afraid, we get gun shy. We won't put ourselves out there, but that's not you, is it?
Oh, no. Always a new adventure.
So speaking of new adventures, what do they have you do there? They don't just put you in a corner and say, well, look, we hired somebody older. What projects are you working on now? What do they have you doing?
Well, I'm engaged in certain projects for certain limited periods of time with them. Then I have my own projects I'm designing as well. But the projects I've been working on with them, one has to do with Medicare services and delivery services. One has to do with designing use of contact lenses for the elderly, how they can manage them more effectively. And I worked on a project for Google, redesigning the interior of their bus, their two-decker buses, that kind of thing. And then I have my own projects.
You know, folks, we're probably going to say this several times during this interview, but let's just reset this thing here. We are talking to a 90-year-old designer for IDEO in Silicon Valley who is redesigning a bus for Google. I mean, how cool is that? And I imagine, Barbara, there's some projects you are working on that you could tell us about, but you'd have to kill us.
I'd be happy to share with. Actually, the design I had for the interior of the Google bus was not activated. It was put on hold until another time, but they liked my ideas. But I have other projects I'm working on that I'm very proud of to help improve the quality of life of elderly people or low vision people, such as I have low vision.
So, you know, I want to learn both ends of this equation, what the younger people at work think about you. But before we go there, you live in a retirement community. What do the other residents in your retirement community think about you?
Well, I think it's been inspiring to them just to hear about what I do, even though they can't engage in the same way.
But they love to hear the stories. And how do you get to work every day?
Well, I live in a retirement community that has transportation to the train, and then I take the train about 30 minutes and then walk 3.5 blocks to the office.
So you get exercise, you're out there moving, you're working your mind.
I walk 2 to 3 miles a day.
Wow. You know, Mark was talking about both ends of the equation. Okay, let's go to the other side now. Everybody you work with is probably in their 20s and 30s. What do they think of you?
Well, you know, they accept me as an equal, which is the most exciting. And, you know, you walk in, everybody gives you a hug, and people come and tell me about their projects. We discuss issues. I work with interns who are there. I work with people who have PhDs. You know, everybody's on an equal level. And it's exciting because everybody shares one thing, and that's passion for creativity and problem solving.
You know, it really is amazing. And, you know, this is one thing our society lacks. And, our role models like you, you know, Bill and I always gripe about the fact that the mainstream media doesn't cover these kind of stories as much as they should. You know, don't you think that more people would be like you if they knew that it was possible, if they knew that a company might actually hire someone that's 90?
Well, I think it may be a breakthrough for people to even consider the skills that people have, no matter how old they are. They have the same, they have a longitudinal experience that I bring to IDEO for projects on aging that the young people can't possibly have.
And you've got a perspective, too, that they don't. You know, maybe you don't understand everything about Twitter, but your life experience has led you to have an understanding that younger people can't even come close to.
Well, I can do conceptual designs of things. For instance, one thing I'm really anxious to try to do is to create something as a fall protection device having to do with airbags, because falling is the biggest hazard for elderly people.
So we would be wearing some sort of an airbag suit?
Yes, a belt that would activate at 15 degrees lurch.
Man, that is very, very cool. You know, Bill mentioned something that made me think of something that I think is fairly interesting. The tools that you use to design have changed radically, in the past decade, for sure. Many times as people age, they cannot keep up with the tools of their industry or their profession. Are you online? Are you plugged in? Do you use the new digital and electronic tools that are at your disposal?
I use it on Saturdays because we have a computer specialist come and work with us, and he'll take out anything I ask him to do on the Internet. I can't see it, but I can. If he prints it out, I can enlarge it. So that's the way I have to do it. I don't go on the Internet myself because there's no way I can see it. I have very low vision, but that doesn't mean I can't appreciate what other people do, and I consider myself to be a conceptual designer because I can see the connection between technology and the needs of people who are aging or have low vision.
Yeah, by ignoring people once they hit 65, certainly by the time they're 90, what kind of resource are we turning our backs on in people of age that have these incredible thoughts?
It's a wasteland. We can't afford to waste it.
So what do you say to people out there, Barbara? I mean, you know, give us the moral of this story. I mean, it's so cool to see what you're doing. It's great to be inspired by you. But if we all just leave it like that as a society, if we just say, wow, look at Barbara, isn't she cool, and don't get something bigger than that from it, I think we're blowing it here. What is the message? What is the moral? What can we learn about your experience at your age?
Well, I've never stopped learning. I've never stopped doing and designing and creating. I start thinking from the time my feet hit the floor in the morning, and I value uninterrupted time. I have no electronic devices except a cell phone for emergency use when I have it on me all the time. But I have uninterrupted time to think. I stay very active. I engage in people all ages, which is exciting. through my church, through my work, through I just go out and walk and meet people.
And why do you think that you're still as vibrant as you are? Were you like a health nut or an exercise person?
No, not really. I was a rower and a sculler. At age 60, I started rowing and sculling at Dartmouth on the Connecticut River. I have always been very active, but I have not been an exercise enthusiast. But I love to walk, and it gives me good time to think.
And you know what? You are a great conversationalist, a tremendous interview. Folks, her name is Barbara Beskind. At 90 years old, she's a conceptual designer for one of the top human-centered design firms in the entire world. As she said, this is the greatest chapter of her life at 90 years old, something that can give us all hope. And I think the important thing to remember is that Barbara never would have gotten the job that she has now if she weren't willing to take that chance, weren't willing to put herself out there, weren't willing to risk rejection. She is as positive a role model for active aging as there is. Our thanks to Barbara Beskind.
Up next, a pianist who was too classical for rock and too rock for classical until he finally made his mark with the Moody Blues. And yes, this is Growing Bolder. Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures.
This is Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and you're about to meet one of the most unique musicians of the classic rock era. The talents of Patrick Mraz helped bands like Yes and the Moody Blues explore a sound that really was different than that of any other groups. It was distinctive, instantly identifiable, and after spending some time with him, you're going to quickly realize that his mind is just as different as his art. Bill Schaefer had that chance. He got Bolder backstage with Patrick Mraz to give us a glimpse of the man behind the music.
Patrick.
Yeah.
How are you?
Fantastico. Unbelievable, man.
Watching Patrick Mraz play is an unusual experience. You never know what you're going to hear, as he often makes melodies up on the fly. And as fast as his hands are, his mind is just as quick. A conversation with Mraz is an amusement park ride of consciousness, wit, and wisdom.
I've had the great fortune, in a way, to be free enough to stay not only healthy, but alive, and alive with my mind, and not be inhibited or forbidden by some tasks or some rules or something. I still respect, of course, the rules of the game, you know, especially in music, you know. But as I always said, you know, music is music, and conversely, music is music.
And music has been his path to a pretty interesting life. He joined the band Yes in 1974, taking the place of the legendary Rick Wakeman. He was a great fit. Everyone was excited about the possibilities until it ended just 2 years later when Wakeman decided to come back. Eventually, Mraz took his wall of keyboards to the Moody Blues, where he continued to make a real connection with the audience.
Some of my very best times on stage and playing the music with Yes, and playing, of course, with Moody Blues, with whom I was for 13 years, you know,
But your time with Yes, when you replace a legend, people don't want to like you yet. Yes fans say that what you did with Relayer was wonderful.
I think they have a very good taste, you know. Of course, Yes was always one of my favorite bands since they started in 50 years ago.
One of the reasons Meraz has been able to survive in the music industry all these years is his ability to do what he's doing right now at an astonishing level, improvising.
I don't only play music or compose music. I mean, I've composed maybe more than 3,000 pieces of music so far, but I still do and I still improvise as well, and I'm still able to compose in real time some music at any given time. See, that's it.
He says he believes the key for any of us to be truly creative is to not be afraid to use your brain, your entire brain.
It's so easy to have the two parts of one's brain communicate, you know, with the two sides by doing very, very simple kind of things which I've developed, of course, over the years. And then also not be inhibited by exploring. Voilà, that's it. That's the exploration of, you know, a new musical or artistic territories, you know.
Perhaps most remarkable is that his desire to explore, whether we're talking about music or life, is just as strong as ever. How old are you now?
Oh, I'm going to be 74 in 3 weeks, actually, you know.
Look at you. Look at your energy. Look at your passion. Did you ever think that this is the way you would be at 74?
I've never really thought about it, actually, you know.
You don't feel 74, do you?
No.
It's interesting, the way you look at your music is also the way you live your life. What the next day is going to bring. It's another adventure. It's more unknown. It's the curiosity as to what's to come. What do you think the takeaway is? What can we learn from what you know about life?
Since I come from Switzerland originally, you know, the peace and the coexistence has always played an immense role in my creativity, because the epitome of creativity lies in the state of dynamic tension between extreme forces in opposition. And the more extreme the forces, the more the creativity is happening.
So what you're saying is not to fear the tension.
Right. Exactly.
Not to fear the tough times that we have, because from that comes our next great composition.
Yeah. Man, yeah, I tell you what, man, you understand everything, huh? Yeah.
You're a great teacher.
It's fantastic. You have understood everything, you know. It's fantastic to have your questions and to be able to talk about all this like that.
Wow, Bill, you are right. Patrick Meraz is a fascinating personality, and he makes a great point about facing challenges. If we can just hold on and find a way to fight through them, we'll be so much better on the other side. Because as we've learned many times, facing adversity forces us to overcome, to rethink, and ultimately to grow.
Yeah, you know why he's so much fun, Mark? You sort of forget the way that the world is set up now. You almost forget how much fun it is to meet someone with tons of energy and a totally different perspective on life than you have. He's like he's like going to a theme park and just to have a conversation with him, because you never know where you're going to end up, what hills and valleys, but you know you're going to come out fascinated and inspired as well. It's so easy to believe that these musicians that we meet on Boulder Backstage have it made, not a problem in the world. But Patrick has had many ups and downs. But when you hear a rock star, this is the point here, in his mid-70s, sound so positive, so enthusiastic and interested in what he's doing, it makes you believe we should all be that way too.
Coming up, the man who successfully pulled off what may be the most famous act of artistic rebellion in history, a stunt that stunned the world.
Sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts.
You are listening to Growing Boulder. I'm Mark Middleton, and our next guest knows a little something about Growing Boulder. In 1974, he took an epic, illegal, daredevil, high-wire walk between the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in what has been called one of the, if not the, most famous act of artistic rebellion in history. He's the author of 10 books, including To Reach for the Clouds, which was the inspiration for the 2008 Oscar-winning documentary Man on a Wire about his walk between the World Trade Center towers. His newest book is Creativity, the Perfect Crime. It's being called a revolutionary look at the creative process and how to live beyond our limitations. Let's welcome Philippe Petit. Hello, Philippe. How are you?
Very good.
Man, you know, you say you don't believe in books about creativity, so why did you decide to write one?
Well, actually, most of the books on creativity are written by an author who involves and presents great creators, but the author himself or herself might not be one. And I'm a little bit tired of that. What I present in this book is the true living creativity of an author who experiences all what he is talking about. And actually, I tell stories and I even do drawings to share my creative life with people. So nothing is invented. It's not a treatise. It's a live testimony.
And what a life it's been. I mean, you were a rebellious young man thrown out of 5 schools basically for being you, which to a large degree cultivated your belief that creativity is illegal, and to be creative, you have to be an outlaw, right?
Well, yes, it's not only a metaphor, but, you know, if you're not free yourself from all convention to start inventing, to start creating, then your creation is going to be quite timid and in a beaten path. So this rebellious feeling is something, to me, inherent to the art of creating.
And when it comes to many of your creative endeavors, I've read that you often say, oops, I forgot to ask permission. Asking permission is not part of the creative process, is it?
Well, generally speaking, no. I mean, I will be careful to address this discourse if I were doing a commencement address in a university, for example. But it is true that to learn the rule is sometimes unnecessary unless you have the force to forget what you just learned. It is true that a creative act has something rebellious by nature, because you should invent and you should feel like everything is possible. Well, that's not right. Nothing is permissible. Nothing is possible to do. We are being told that every day, you know. This is impossible. You cannot do this. You cannot do that. So it became very naturally. It was not a thought in my life or a choice, but it was an experience that really I should not ask permission. I should do things, you know. But of course, what I do is not, even though sometimes it looks like a bank robbery, is I do not steal, I do not take, I do the opposite. I offer, I inspire, I enrich people's life. I don't say that. They say that to me after a performance, you know.
Folks, we are speaking to Philippe Petit, who is a high wire artist, a street performer who for decades has just amazed people worldwide. He's the author of Creativity, the Perfect Crime. And as we mentioned, he's a high wire artist. And of course, your most famous act was that 1974 walk between the World Trade Center towers. It took you at least 6 years to plan it. You secretly rigged 450-pound cable that went 1,350 feet above the ground, and then using only a balancing pole, you walk back and forth 8 times. What did that do for your career? You were arrested. They later dropped the charges, but people just stood on the streets in awe, didn't they?
You know, I don't have a career. I have a life. So every step in my life is what I want to do. It's not a system or a plan to achieve a certain notoriety or get money. I mean, I've been very very bad at enriching myself, and that's not my goal in life. My goal in life is to present beautiful performance and then have people afterwards say, Philippe, you changed my life. I now believe I can move mountains. I mean, that what a great profession it is to have people say that after performances. So the World Trade Center was improvised, and people salute it as the biggest thing in my life, but I can assure you I have done things of equal artistic quality that were passed unnoticed sometimes.
For those who haven't seen the film, I have. I loved it. Did you like the film, Philippe?
Well, Man on Wire was a phenomenon because actually it started after Sundance. We started getting all the prizes and all the achievements, awards, and then all the way to the Oscar, which I actually, and at the ceremony, you saw me balance on my chin, which was the first time somebody ever balanced an Oscar like this, like a juggler. And yes, the life of that film, it's a great documentary, was astonishing. But I have a secret in my sleeve right now. There is a feature film in three dimension about that subject about to be made.
Wow, that is fabulous. The film documents, you know, very interestingly, your love affair with the World Trade Center towers. From the moment you heard they were being built, you became fixated on doing what you did. What was 9/11 like for you, given your love affair with the towers? How did you react to that?
Well, I cannot talk about that, of course, but you can imagine. The reason I cannot talk about it is how can I talk about the disappearance of two great monuments when actually we're talking about the disappearance of thousands of human lives. But if you follow my history and read my book and see the documentary, you will see that those towers really were alive in my heart. And therefore, you can imagine how I felt when they disappeared.
You're now in your mid-60s, Philippe. Is it easier or harder for you to break the rules? Are you as creative now as you were 30 years ago?
Oh, that's a nice question. And by the way, I don't believe in age, but yes, I am 65. And it's both. It's easier because I have attained a certain mastery and a knowledge that allows me to get quicker to my goal. And it's more difficult because life has changed and people don't believe in miracles as much as in the past, and I have to fight to actually do my film, my book, my performance, my lecture, my buildings, my drawings. It's I do so many things that actually it's a fighting front for me to continue to act my art. But at the same time, yes, it becomes a little bit easier because of all my life behind me. So again, I live in a life of contradiction, and my answer here is black and white. It's easier and it's harder.
Still a rebel in your mid-60s. In our final 40 seconds here, Philippe, what's the life lesson that you want us all to learn from you? What's the moral of the Philippe Petit story?
You know, I have no lesson to teach. I have no moral to impose. Basically, my book on creativity is a testimony of a lifetime of somebody who refused to abide by the rules. And what I do in this book is which I do in my lecture, I don't impose knowledge. I open doors. And it is for my readers or the people who listen to me or look at my works to pick up whatever will enrich their life. But there is always something to pick up, and that's why people come to me and say, Philippe, you have inspired us. So I know this book will inspire readers as well.
Folks, he is Philippe Petit, a very interesting man with an incredible history and an astounding future, we know. Pick up his book. It's called Creativity, the Perfect Crime. I know you won't be disappointed. Philippe, thank you so much for your time.
Coming up next, a man on a mission to help people live leaner and longer. An international fitness expert who says he's figured out the key to losing body fat, and he's going to give you the proof to back it up. Stay connected to Growing Boulder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures. I'm Bill Schaefer, along with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Boulder. Our next guest is such an awesome guy. He's one of America's top fitness experts. As an amateur bodybuilder, the guy won dozens of major titles, and I'm talking about even back into the 60s and 70s. He was collegiate Mr. America, and the guy spent nearly two decades as the director of research for Nautilus. And in that time, Mark, he helped change the way the world works out.
Yeah, he really did. Kind of an iconic guy in the industry. And, you know, he's got a brain to match the body, Bill, a master's degree in physical education, a doctorate in exercise science, and then 2 years of postdoctoral study in food and nutrition. He, in fact, has been called one of the top 10 health leaders in the U.S. by the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition. He's the author of many best-selling books, and his latest could actually be his greatest. It's called The Body Fat Breakthrough: Tap the Muscle Building Power of Negative Training and Lose Up to 30 Pounds in 30 Days. Welcome, folks, the legendary fitness researcher, Dr. Ellington Darden. Hey, Ellington, how are you?
Hey, Mark, Bill, doing good.
Wait, we appreciate you taking a break from all you're doing to chat with us. You know, what we like most about you is you're not a bodybuilder who is a smart guy. You're a smart guy who is also a bodybuilder. I mean, you have studied the science of exercise and weight training and applied those principles in a healthy way, which is very, very cool. What led you to write The Body Fat Breakthrough?
Well, I for the last 50 years, I'm just seeing more and more adults and even children, both male and female, it seems like they get fatter and fatter and fatter every several years. And the statistics in the United States point this out. You know, we are a group of people that have, if we're not the fattest country in the world, we're either second or third, you know. So what prompted me to get interested and to write this book is to see if I couldn't find some solutions that would stick, as opposed to a lot of the solutions out there that don't seem to stick or work very long.
Well, that brings me to this question, El, because you say we're all fat, but I bet you we'd lead the world in weight loss. The problem is we put the weight right back on again. It happens to everybody. What are we doing wrong?
Well, I think what we're doing wrong is that we're not building muscle at the same time as you're losing weight. You know, that's about the only way to make sure that the weight loss that you have is 100% fat. And that is to strength train, to body build, to actually increase the size of your muscles as you decrease the size of your fat cells. So that's what this book is about, how to do it very efficiently.
That is a really interesting concept. And, you know, I call it a concept, and it's really not that, because you did a lot of research with a bunch of people in Gainesville, Florida. What did the research show?
Well, the research shows that if you accentuate the lowering, the negative part of any exercise you do, then that makes a deeper fatiguing situation in the involved muscles. And that, in turn, kicks into action about 6 or 7 hormones, which pull calories from your fat cells and also facilitates the building of muscle. So the concept that I just described earlier to you of building muscle to lose fat, it's facilitated both the loss of fat and the building of muscle if you learn how to accentuate the negative phase of each exercise.
So what are you talking about here? Doing, you know, getting on that bench and doing a ton of reps?
No. It's a very slow 1.5 repetition, and each phase of the repetition. Let's say you're doing a push-up. Everybody knows how to do a push-up. So you start at the top, and you take from 20 to 30 seconds to lower yourself. So you don't drop down quickly. You go down very smooth and slow. And then if you're strong enough at the bottom, you push up in another 20 to 30 seconds, and then you go back down in a final 20 to 30 seconds. So you've got 1.5 repetitions, and that takes anywhere from 60 to 90 seconds. So you can apply that same concept to any barbell exercise or any weight machine exercise, and that's what I did in Gainesville.
You know, this is really fascinating stuff, folks. And as we mentioned, Ellington is a bodybuilder. But don't let that discourage you or distract you from what he's saying. This is not about bodybuilding. This is about improving your strength and losing weight. And this whole negative exercise is negative training. For people that didn't get that, Ellington, I mean, you're basically flipping this 180 degrees, and maybe a bench press would be the best example, although you just gave a great one with a push-up. On a bench press, most people would think that the exercise portion, the most important thing, was pushing the weight off of their chest. You're saying to lower it very, very slowly. That's the negative part, right?
That's correct. And you do twice as much lowering as you do raising. So I'm not saying that the raising part isn't also a factor. It is. But you want to accentuate, you want to emphasize the lowering portion. So you take the bench press at the top and you come down in 20 to 30 seconds. You push it up in 20 to 30 seconds, and then you lower one more time in 20 to 30 seconds and have someone help you get it off. So it's you have to use less resistance than you'd normally use. Well, if you're using 100 pounds for 10 repetitions, you'd cut it to 75 or 80 and try the, I call it 30-30-30. So you'd try 30-30-30 with about 75 to 80% of what you can normally do 10 times.
Well, there is more than just working out to the body fat breakthrough. You also include lifestyle changes that help people gain muscle and lose weight. In fact, you call these fat bombs. And
yeah.
And is it possible to lose 30 pounds in 30 days by avoiding the fat bombs?
Well, yes, it's possible. Now, you have to be in a certain category. We had 7 out of the first group of 44 people, I think it was about half men and half women, 7 that did lose 30 pounds in 30 days. But all of these, all of the men that lost that amount were, you know, well over 240 pounds. One of them weighed 302 pounds, and he lost 80 pounds in 80 days. It was remarkable. So you've got to have a lot of fat on you to do that. But getting back to what I was talking about, yeah, there's 7 or 8 other things you got to do besides this negative accentuated exercise. You got to cut back on your dietary calories. You got to drink a lot of ice cold water a day, and you got to emphasize resting and sleeping as opposed to being active. So those are the 3 or 4 main things that you need to do.
You know, folks, you got to check it out. It's called The Body Fat Breakthrough. It's written by Dr. Ellington Darden, who is a world-renowned exercise physiologist, nutritionist. I mean, he is the guy. And as we've all learned, diets don't work. And he's written a book that tells you why they don't work. And if you will pay attention to this book, you will finally have the results that you want and the results that will stay off. And we mean that emphatically. Check it out. Dr. Ellington Darden's new book, The Body Fat Breakthrough. Elle, thanks so much for your time. Coming up next, a woman near death transforms her kitchen into her personal healing laboratory and uses food to cure herself of multiple conditions. This is Growing Bolder.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Boulder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
I am Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Bolder. Our next guest did exactly that because she is one of the 55 million Americans who suffer from an autoimmune disease. She was in a health crisis with hereditary Crohn's disease, a cancer diagnosis, and debilitating pain, Mark, every single day that made it even difficult for her to eat.
Yeah, she was very weak, an unhealthy 96 pounds, suffering, as Bill said, from multiple medical conditions, and she feared the treatments might actually kill her before they could cure her. So here's the neat part of this story. She turned to her kitchen, and she turned it into a laboratory, and then transformed herself into one of the world's top autoimmune cooking experts and the author of My Kitchen Cure, How I Cooked My Way Out of Chronic Autoimmune Disease and Prevented Cancer with Whole Foods and Healing Recipes. Welcome, Mi Tracy McCormick. Hi, Mi. How are you?
I'm super-duper good. How are you guys?
Man, that's great to hear you're super-duper good because, as we just learned, you've not always been that way. And you know what, Mi? We love your story on so many levels, and not just because you're helping so many others, but because you somehow had the ability, the drive, the passion to solve your own problem by reinventing yourself. How desperate were you at your lowest point?
Pretty desperate. You know, I was, once I unwrapped all the fear, I sort of found my feet in my decision to live. I mean, it was really just, you know, we can live. If we're alive and we're suffering, then we're not really living. And I had watched my mother suffer Crohn's disease in the 80s and, I mean, slowly bleed to death in her case. My symptoms were different. But as I looked into the face of my five-year-old daughter, I saw my own five-year-old self, and I saw the helplessness, and I thought, well, I'm passing that on, and that's not what I want to pass on. I mean, I had done everything in my life to reinvent my life and to create a life different from my mother's, from, you know, not getting married at 18 and a lot of different choices, obvious choices. But when the illness came up and caught me, that was, I just didn't want to be her, and she died at 39. And I know she wouldn't have wanted me to be her either. And so I saw myself and my daughter, and I just, you know, grabbed a rope and decided to go forward in a different direction. And it's pretty special to me. I think that's what I'm most proud of, is that I've shown my capability to my children. And hopefully one day that'll pay off and they'll know that they can change their lives. In all different types of ways.
Now, I'm sure it didn't happen as quick as a snap of the fingers. I mean, I'm imagining that you went off on some huge journey to try to find answers, not immediately looking to your own kitchen for the answer, but probably going to a string of doctors first.
Oh, I was at every hospital. I was with many doctors. And, you know, with autoimmune disease, it's incredibly complicated, and they're not really certain how to treat it because everyone's immune system reacts differently. The symptoms are different. And so it's really complicated. But I just had watched my mother take all kinds of drugs and meds and go through things, and she didn't get well. And I thought, if the only thing touching the lining of my intestines is food, then that's either going to hurt it or help it. And it was a slow process. I mean, it's not overnight that you get sick. There's been tons of studies that show that autoimmune disease, you have the antibodies in your body for 7 years before you have the symptom. Mm. So you don't get sick overnight, and we don't get well overnight. But that journey to wellness is a journey, you know, and it was a fantastic journey because it was a journey to know myself, to learn my capability, and it turned into an adventure that I'm proud of, and I'm honored that I was able to make it.
So you go to doctors who have the degree, the authority, you know, all of that, and they're all prescribing, diagnosing, telling you that you need some sort of pharmacological intervention. But you say, you know, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try to figure out how to fix it myself. So we mentioned that you turned your kitchen into a laboratory, and that's really what you did, isn't it?
Yeah, I did. And I was a terrible cook, the worst cook you've ever seen, ever met, shot via the pictures on the box. And, you know, in defense of doctors, I think they're the most special people on the planet, and nurses. And I come from a line of nurses. And what we've done is we've given them all this power, and we've also put all this pressure on them to fix us, but we're not participating with them. So, you know, my thing was, if you're going to take medicine, what are you going to eat with that medicine to support it? Like, how are we going to support ourselves? And we've sort of told ourselves these stories that unless we're not doctors, chefs, or nutritionists, or scientists, we can't do anything for ourselves. And that's a really tragic message because it's so disempowering to our culture and to our children. And I did. I got in my kitchen. Listen, if for thousands of years people were ever able to cook themselves into wellness, why can't we, as intelligent we are as we are, and access to information is at our fingertips with Google and books. And so I just looked at food. I would research the value of everything I was eating. I tried to find side effects, benefits, wise tales, and then I would get in the kitchen and create all kinds of slop at first that turned into eventually beautiful meals. And I just changed my complete relationship and mental point of view around food. And now I eat and I cook with a purpose and an intention. And that's what people did for thousands of years, hundreds of years in this country. And we stopped doing that. Now we eat purely for taste, calories, and fat. And those are the three things that come into our mind when we go to cook dinner. How many calories, how much fat, and what does it taste like? And shifting that into what's in it, what it does, how it works, and of course it's going to taste good because it's natural, is a different point of view.
I know that you had gotten to the point where you were quite desperate. Can people make that change without being desperate? I mean, we like fat, we like calories, and we like taste.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, I mean, I use a lot of fat. That's the thing. When people eat my food now, they go, oh, it's really good. Well, I have a Latin background, nationality. I live in the South, Nashville, so it's got to taste good. And I just learned to use things. You know, what's happening is it used to be, you know, like look at health insurance. It used to be we would get insurance in case we got sick. What if we get sick? But now it's called health care for when we get sick. So this type of thinking is now part of our culture. You know, what is it, 2 out of 3 men will have cancer, or some insane will have some type of cancer in their lifetimes, and women as well. It's really what's going on with our health is obvious. You know, when I was a little girl, the only person in my school that I knew that was sick was my mother. And now in my kids' school, it's a very small school, I think it's every 2 people have some sort of situation. And so we're aware that we are getting sicker. And with that, hopefully, will become the ability to be preventative with our food. And I really do see a movement with it. I run community kitchens in Nashville, and I cook with upwards of 150 to 200 people in the street. And when I run these community kitchens, I have to turn people away. And these aren't the health foodie people. Those aren't the people that are coming out. It's rural people. It's ethnic people. It's minority. It's all of us, because we're all in this. And so it's not that it... I think the health food movement was a West Coast, East Coast thing, but I live in the heartland, and the people that are coming out are average American people that are sick or don't want to get sick. So, you know, if there's someone in your house who's not well and you're raising children, and, you know, children are growing up with sick parents and seeing the world that they're in. So I think the future generation will be the preventative generation, but hopefully we can inspire that and encourage that.
Well, Tracy McCormick is certainly doing her part. She suffers from autoimmune disease, but folks, there's no shortage of sickness in this country. We have a health crisis, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, cancer, you name it, we got it. She says the cure is in your kitchen, and you can learn more by reading her great new book. It's called My Kitchen Cure, How I Cooked My Way Out of Chronic Autoimmune Disease and Prevented Cancer with Whole Foods and Healing Recipes. You can find out more at her website, that's MeeTracy.com.
We hope we've inspired you to not only chase your dreams, but to appreciate the many blessings that we all have and tend to take for granted.
And what do you say, Bill? We leave them with another takeaway. This one is from Marlo Thomas, the daughter of the late, great Danny Thomas. And Marlo, of course, is an actress, a producer, and a social activist, probably best known for starring in the sitcom That Girl. She was a guest on this very program, and she told us this, quote, "My father always said there were two kinds of people in the world, the givers and the takers. The takers eat better, but the givers sleep better." Something to think about, folks, because growing bolder is about sleeping better. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.